This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Hear about food insecurity in rural central Illinois and in some parts of Peoria, where insecurity is a third higher than the state average.
We exceeded the Illinois rate, and so we really thought, wow, we've got to put our heads together and we can do better than that.
Tim Shelley talks with Jill Garrison of OSF and others about how to fix food insecurity. Plus, Colleen Reynolds has the finalists for Bloomington Police Chief. Tell us what they believe are the pressing problems of law enforcement in the city. Mary Cullen reports on Central Illinois Congressman Darren LaHood and Rodney Davis's appearance before the Chamber of Commerce. And John Norton brings us the politically aware music of Josh Ritter. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington Police Chief job search has moved from private interviews to public ones. WGLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds caught up with the two finalists for the job at a community meet and greet. Let's hear first from former state police captain and Parkland College Police Chief Bill Colebrook. Colebrook says he has a passion for law enforcement. He got into it to serve the community and make a difference. 34 years later, he is still at it.
Being a former resident of Bloomington, longstanding former resident of Bloomington, I want to take my experiences, my law enforcement experiences, my passion for community policing, my ability to reach out to all groups and talk to all people, regardless of background or opinion, and to forge relationships and to make a difference in this community.
Knowing what you know about the city of Bloomington, and even perhaps based on some of what you heard from community residents, what do you think is the biggest challenge for community relations and crime in this community?
Well, I think there's three challenges that I spoke of: the gun violence, the fear of crime, and the community relations. And, you know, based on my experience over in Champaign-Urbana as the chief of police, I've got a very good handle on what some of the success strategies are in dealing with gun violence. The fear of crime, part of that is kind of two-part. One is, what are you doing to combat the violence? And the other is, how well are you communicating those efforts to the community? So if you're a community member and you don't work in the police department, you're wondering, you know, what is, you know, the people who are supposed to be doing something, what are they doing? Well, with my ability to communicate with anybody and everybody, I will be completely transparent, and I will let the community know what we are doing, so they have a sense of, you know, what some of the strategies are, why we're doing it, and also when you involve other people in those communication efforts, they get a buy-in into the solution. You know, people don't like to be kept out in the dark of what the solutions are. So if I bring community members in and we communicate properly to the community, to the citizens, of what we believe the problem is and what steps and efforts we are taking to combat it, then that fear of crime actually goes down. And as far as community relations, it's all about relationships. You know, I've built relationships my entire career. That's what we do at Parkland College at the moment. You know, that's one of the shining, you know, stars in my repertoire is building relationships. I am willing, and I will, on a continuous basis, meet with you know, any constituent group that wants to meet with me. I will do outreach in the community. I will go to neighborhoods. I will go to faith-based leaders. I will go to churches. I will meet with organizations, whether it's the Elks Club or any other benevolent association. I will go to schools. I will go, you know, wherever it takes to build those relationships. And just like we say in the emergency management arena, you never want to be exchanging business cards, you know, on the day of an emergency. The same thing with the City of Bloomington. I will have built those relationships ahead of time. I will have built the trust between the community and me, and thus the community and the police department. So then when something does happen and we collaboratively try to come up with a solution, we already know each other. We already trust each other.
You were getting some feedback about immigrants in the community being afraid to come forward. How would you approach the strategy for reassuring immigrants who are undocumented that they can trust the police department if they're a victim of a crime or if they see crime happen?
So just to be clear on my position, the Illinois Trust Act is the guiding law on this issue. And it'd be no different than what I already do as Chief of Police at Parkland College. If a federal agency such as ICE comes with a signed warrant from a magistrate or a judge, it's a criminal matter, then we would participate, have professional relationships with ICE and regarding that criminal matter. If the issue is regarding the status of a resident based on their immigration status alone, I view that as a federal ICE issue. We will let the federal agency do what their mission is and their job, and we will not participate in that. What I will do in order to make undocumented immigrants safe is I'm going to meet with them. The same conversations I'm having tonight, I'm going to have those conversations out in the community, and they'll be able to look me in the eye, and we can talk about it for hours, and my position will never change. The residents of this community should feel safe in their existence. We will let the federal government and particularly the agency of ICE to take care of what their mission statement is, and we will take care of what our mission statement is, which is to combat crime, ensure the safety of the residents and visitors of the City of Bloomington. And once again, it's through those relationships, it's through that trust, it's through those communications, and maybe it won't be just one time. Maybe it's going to have to take multiple times. You know, if you are in fear of getting detained based solely on your immigration status, you may feel reluctant to come forward if you're a victim. We want those folks to participate in the process that's going to help make this community safe. So we need them to have that comfort level, that trust, to be able to come forward and tell us if they're a victim, tell us if they have information that we can then use to help solve crime, which in the end makes the City of Bloomington safer.
ICE is going to come in, and now we're seeing it happen, and they reach out to City of Bloomington. We're doing this. We got to block off some streets. We need your assistance.
I don't want to get ahead of myself, and from where I stand now, without having been involved, you know, my response is the same thing. If they are doing an operation that's based solely on the immigration status of residents, then we're going to let ICE handle that. If they have something that's criminal in nature, then it's a different conversation entirely.
We have a council member who wants to put together a task force that would include police to make Bloomington a recreational marijuana tourism destination. What are your thoughts about recreational marijuana, and would you be in favor of that sort of open embracing of what is going to be legal as an economic development opportunity?
Well, I don't know how prepared I am to talk about some of these concepts that you just talked about, because it's the first I've heard of it. But the legalization of marijuana in general, I understand from one perspective, you know, that people say, you know, that it's not a gateway drug, it's not this, it's not that, and I appreciate their perspective. But I also appreciate from a law enforcement perspective, you know, we've got to be very cognizant of some of the issues that may come of that. You know, obviously, if somebody is operating a motor vehicle or heavy machinery, we cannot have somebody that's under the influence of drugs, you know, operating a vehicle on the roadways of the state of Illinois or the city of Bloomington. So, you know, it's a very, very complicated issue. It's not simple, and it won't be decided upon, you know, in a single study session or a city council meeting. But it's certainly something that needs to be talked about, because once again, I get where society is evolving, is changing. But at the same time, I believe there's some legitimate public safety concerns that need to be raised.
You talked about bringing the police department into the 21st century. Lots of businesses, government agencies, healthcare are all going to big data, artificial intelligence. Where do you see that going to help police in ways that it isn't today? Do you have a vision?
Well, I do have a vision. You know, that is obviously the track that that governments and in particular police departments, you know, are going. You know, sometimes it's work smarter, not harder. And technology is one of those avenues in which that you can work smarter. There's been police agencies throughout the country that have used crime data, other information, and had a computer, you know, crunch those numbers, and they're able to deploy, you know, their officers in areas at specific, you know, days of the week, specific times of the day, in specific neighborhoods, sometimes down to the street, in order to do directed patrols and affect, you know, what would be predicted crime, you know, whether it's, you know, car burglaries or home burglaries or sexual assaults or whatever the case may be. I think metadata has a place in law enforcement. However, like a gentleman tonight pointed out, there is privacy concerns, and we will have to balance, you know, the privacy concerns of citizens versus the public safety aspects as well. Once again, it's going to take a conversation. It's going to take the opportunity to get all the data, all the facts on the table, and dig deeper, have a deep dive into what that actually means, you know, before we go forward and implement new technologies.
You talked about bringing community policing. What does that really look like, aside from you meeting a lot with individuals? What else does that look like? Day to day, what does that look like?
Well, just to clarify, I wouldn't say I'm bringing it back, because I already know that Bloomington Police Department does community policing. But just when the chief of police walks in the front door and they know that I've committed myself to this philosophy my entire career, that they have an understanding of what philosophy that we're going to have as a police department. You're right. It doesn't just take the chief to be a community policing officer, or the assistant chiefs or the lieutenants. It takes everybody. And, you know, I will encourage, you know, that sort of philosophy out on the street. There's some things, some ideas I've spoke about in the interviews that I really don't want to reveal now, because I think I'd be getting too far ahead of myself. But I need to find ways to encourage the officers to think that community policing is something that you just do automatically. You know, it's just not something, hey, I'm going to check this box and do this today. It needs to be ingrained in your DNA. But there's lots of ideas.
One last question to kind of connect it back to the gun violence and the problems. How does that help, and what other strategies do you have to reducing gun violence?
Kids do not grow up thinking they're going to pick up a gun and pull a trigger. Something along the way has allowed them to do that. There is a thing called, you know, the face I wear, or the mask I wear. I've heard it both ways. And basically, if you have a child who's coming up into young adulthood, you know, he's got certain challenges that they're faced with, and they have a certain persona, and, you know, maybe they pick up a gun because they're scared. Maybe they pick up a gun because they think that's the only way to get money in their pocket. If we can work on building relationships with the smaller kids, the older kids, and the young adults and the parents, then all that does is make a difference. There's all kinds of programs out there, whether it be like a program like Midnight Basketball or other sort of affiliations that can be created where the kids have an opportunity to have relationships, good, solid, safe relationships with other kids. They can be given opportunities for education. They can be given opportunities for maybe a job. There's all kinds of things that can be done. Once again, this just isn't a police problem, a police issue. This is a community issue that needs to be solved by the community.
That's Parkland College Police Chief Bill Colebrook talking with GLT correspondent Colleen Reynolds. Colebrook is one of the finalists for the job of Bloomington Police Chief. The in-house candidate is current interim chief Dan Donath. Donath has been with the department more than 25 years. There is a lot of distrust of police from high-profile police shootings, difficulty recruiting minority officers. Gunfire incidents are increasing in many communities. Donath tells Colleen Reynolds someone has to lead through those times and those challenges.
You know, the challenges for the city of Bloomington, I think the biggest thing right now is gun crime. People, instead of like, if they're going to have an argument, they'll pull out a gun, as opposed to, you know, the old days where you might have a fist fight with somebody. Today's world, it seems like people are a lot quicker to move to a gun and try to resolve some of their issues. So that's the biggest issue for Bloomington itself.
What do you think are your unique characteristics, skills, ability, and background that will help address that?
Well, really, a lot of my life experiences and a lot of my experiences at the police department, I've been very fortunate in my life to experience a lot of different things. I got a great education at Illinois State University, study abroad program where I learned a lot about people. And then I've been very lucky at the police department that my approach to working has got me selected for essentially almost every position in the police department. So I understand all the aspects of our police department, how they work, what they mean, how they interact with each other. And so I think that gives me a distinct advantage as opposed to somebody that may have only worked in one or two areas. They may just not know all the types of things that we do at our police department.
2018, I think, was the deadliest year in sort of recent memory for actual homicides due to gunfire. And there's a lot of debate right now about the role that guns play versus other factors. What's your philosophy about that?
Well, honestly, I don't have a philosophy in a concise sense. There's a lot of factors that play into that, way more than we would probably be able to talk about right now. But there's just all type of things, like, you know, like I talked about, people choosing to go to guns as opposed to a way to resolve their issues. Well, why does that happen? And are there other factors of the way that they grew up or education levels or the environment or national rhetoric? Or, you know, there's all kinds of things that contribute to creating somebody's perspective and how they decide how they're going to handle things. So there's not one clear, concise angle to that. In regards to guns themselves, you know, I don't get into political things about whether they're the appropriate thing and people should have, you know, those rights. That's the rights in the Constitution, and I'm only here to, you know, support the people's rights as far as what my job is within the police department. But whether they belong or don't belong, that's for other people.
We've often heard that it's going to take a collaborative approach to solving the gun-related crimes. Do you have any new ideas, unique strategies that you think you can make a difference with?
Well, I think there's a few things that we can do. Some things we're already doing. We're already being very successful at removing guns from the street. This year alone, already we've removed 20-some guns from the street, which is more than last year. And I've already been in touch with some of the local schools to talk about education and how we can assist with knowledge about guns and their danger and what their role is in our environment, and how we can de-escalate situations between students. So I've already engaged with them about how we might be able to achieve that. One thing you might recall, years ago I taught the DARE program, and we were in the schools and we talked about a lot of different aspects. And so maybe this is an opportunity that we might, you know, have some involvement in the schools and try to help with the education about guns and their safety and things of that nature. But I don't have all the answers per se. I'm not the chief yet, but we have a lot of great smart people, a lot of people with a lot of experience, and we'll talk about all those things, and we'll come up with some strategies that we feel will be very productive, even though we already have been productive in the sense that we've arrested everyone on every one of those murders. There's nobody running around free, and we've taken a lot of guns off the street, so we've already been very proactive about that.
Do you have thick skin? One of the criteria I keep hearing is they've got to be able to take criticism and then do something with that.
Yeah, actually that's one of the great skill sets I have is I don't take offense if people criticize me. In fact, I look for criticism from people. Now, there's certainly people that they're very good at criticizing essentially everything, and so you may not take a lot from them. But there's probably a little bit you can take something from some people. You just have to be honest with yourself and be able to assess, is there some truth to that? Am I maybe not doing something quite right or something wrong? And be honest with yourself. And I've always had that skill set. I'm not afraid to critique myself.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. We're talking with Dan Donath, one of two candidates, finalists for police chief in Bloomington. Recreational marijuana is coming. And we have at least one councilwoman who wants to put together a task force and really make Bloomington a user-friendly environment for that and even welcome tourists and become sort of a destination because of our welcoming of recreational users. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I don't know all the details about what the council person's suggesting, so it's hard for me to comment on that because I really don't know the details of it. And that's one thing I'm careful about commenting on things, that if I really just don't know all the information and the facts about it, I hate to offer up an opinion when I'm really just not knowledgeable.
Do you think a task force is a good idea, knowing that this is coming, to make some determinations about our community attitudes and restrictions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that would probably be an appropriate thing to do because there's multiple factors to it. There's the law enforcement aspect to it, but there also is a city side to it in regards to what they're going to allow businesses to do within the city and where they're going to allow them to do it. So there's multiple facets to that particular that topic.
Do you have anyone strong concern?
Yes and no. I mean, if you look at some of the other states that have legalized marijuana, car accidents are up, DUIs are up, hospital visits are up. So those are some of the things that we see from a law enforcement aspect that would cause some concern. But it really is an open-ended thing, and we'll just have to see, what happens.
AI, artificial intelligence, big data is starting to transform businesses, government, healthcare. How do you see using data to inform your strategy on resource allocation and approach to crime?
Well, certainly, there's some angles to that, but we've been using analytics for crime for some time, and we've been very successful with it. We start to pick up patterns on burglaries, and in fact, we picked up on one last year that was a pretty big burglary situation, and we were able to resolve that, find out who the person was involved, and get them in custody. So we've really been using statistics and analytics for years.
Your biggest challenge, I think you're going to hear, is there is distrust still, I think, between especially the minority community and police. Any other strategies that you have for really trying to improve those relations?
Yeah, absolutely. I want to focus on community policing. Community policing seems to me has really kind of historically been a lot of singular events. And I think community policing should be more of a mindset or a culture so that when we're handling calls for service, we're looking at it from a community policing aspect and not just resolving the call just in general. But I will tell you that the body-worn cameras that we initiated last summer, what we've had for a year now, have been fantastic. All of our encounters are recorded, and it gives us a great opportunity to realize or find out what really happened on a call for service, if there is a question between individuals about what transpired, and now we can just sit back and watch, which is fantastic.
Are you using any of those for training?
We've used them somewhat for training. Mostly, it's mostly been for we actually have had a lot less criminal or citizen complaints this year. For whatever reasons, and then they've been used in criminal cases.
Dan Donath, thank you so much. I'm Colleen Reynolds.
either Interim Chief Dan Dunneth or former State Police Captain and Parkland College Police Chief Bill Colebrook will become the new Bloomington Police Chief probably sometime next week when City Manager Tim Gleason makes the choice.
Don't you worry, baby. Cage the Elephant have become one of the biggest bands in rock and roll, and we'll talk to Brad and Matt Schultz about their latest record, Social Cues, and we'll find out what the consequences are of being one of the best live acts on the planet.
I had separated my rib cage from my sternum. I've broken a couple ribs before.
It's Cage the Elephant on an encore edition of World Cafe.
It's World Cafe weeknights at 7 on Bloomington Normal's Public Media, WGLT.
Support for WGLT comes from Green Top Grocery, proudly a co-op and now taking advantage of bulk buying power along with other co-ops across the country. This means thousands of items at a lower cost to customers. Details at the store or at greentopgrocery.com. This is 89.1 WGLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, Mary Cullen reports on the August recess visit to town of two of Central Illinois' congressmen. A new report details a culture of sexual harassment in Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan's office. Madigan commissioned the audit from a Chicago law firm after coming under fire for not properly handling complaints that came out of the Me Too movement. It shows how Madigan's own staff feel he is unapproachable and unavailable, and how his former chief of staff ruled by using fear. IPR Politics reporters Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney spoke with Mel Bellera about the report's findings. Mel Bellera begins by asking Dave McKinney what the report said about sexual harassment in the Speaker's office.
Well, this report took more than a year to pull together. It was done by former federal prosecutor Maggie Hickey. It laid out a really miserable experience for low-level women staffers in Madigan's office. You know, amongst themselves, as soon as they would get these jobs, they would counsel one another to be on the lookout for men in the Capitol who displayed what Hickey described as creepy behavior. These workers kind of, you know, amongst themselves, counseled one another not to drink alcohol, to not go out after hours with the legislators. Don't look as if they were, in Hickey's words, too available. I mean, some women, Melba, even went so far as to wear fake wedding rings to fend off, you know, some of this bad behavior that was going on under Madigan's watch.
Yeah, and Tony, I understand a lot of this report focuses not only on Speaker Mike Madigan, but his former chief of staff gets a lot of detail here. Why does it focus so much on him?
Well, it actually details how Madigan was basically so unavailable to staff that a lot of the day-to-day work was laid upon the chief of staff then, Tim Mapes. And Mapes was seen as the guy who would get stuff done. Of course, that now came at a heavy cost. There are a lot of examples of how Mapes would bully staff in this report. People complained that they had to do demeaning tasks for state representatives, like vacuum apartments, drive them around, run errands, even help sell homes. The audit also found that Mapes would use fear against underlings. He would frequently remind them that they were dispensable and could lose their jobs. I should note here that Mapes actually lost his job. He was fired last year amid some specific bullying allegations.
And Dave, can you give us some context here? Madigan is arguably the most powerful politician in Illinois. He's been in office since 1971. Where does the buck stop with him?
Well, you're right. I mean, he is the longest serving speaker in American history. But this really is a blemish on his legacy. I mean, he can't escape blame for this because it all happened on his watch. You know, the report, it makes Michael Madigan seem almost as if he's like the Wizard of Oz. I mean, he's unavailable to staff. They don't see him around. Many of the people who work for him say they've never interacted with him. And the problem with that is that a lot of these people told Hickey that they weren't sure he would have their back if they were to issue a complaint to him because he wouldn't know them. When this report came out, he issued a statement along with it accepting responsibility. But here's the other takeaway from the report. I mean, in spite of all the problems, Hickey seems to give Madigan a pass. She praised his cooperation. And, you know, he gets plenty of mention, but he's almost a footnote to Mapes. You know, for example, in the whole report, you add up the number of times Madigan gets mentioned. It's 192 times. By comparison, Mapes gets mentioned nearly twice that many times.
And Tony, once we get a report like this and it comes out, how does it change the culture in the Illinois State House?
Well, there are some recommendations in this report. It kind of goes out of the way to notice that a lot of the staff who work in the Speaker's office are young people who are just trying to make it in politics or new to politics and are trying to make it. And then you add this dynamic then of some really established people who are much older, and they are the ones who have a lot of the power here. So some of the recommendations that it lists include that basically Madigan should be more visible to his staff. And that would be a huge culture shift, really, for a 77-year-old House Speaker. The report also recommends that power should be dispersed more within the Speaker's office, like give more people responsibilities, hire an ethics officer. Don't make it all just the general counsel of the office to deal with these issues. There's still some other questions about how Madigan has dealt with harassment issues. We know that there have been allegations made against some of his people in his political organizations and how that's been handled, and that Madigan has commissioned audits about how that was handled. Those have not been made public. We still don't know what those reports or those findings are. There's even still a civil lawsuit that's still pending on that front.
IPR's Tony Arnold and Dave McKinney talking with Mel Ballara about a report on a culture of bullying and harassment in the office of Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan. Tim Mapes is out with a statement defending his tenure as Madigan's chief of staff. He writes, "The criticisms against him don't appreciate how much responsibility he had." And, quote, "If my demeanor or approach to my job did not instill trust and a healthy work environment, I apologize." This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, music with John Norton. Central Illinois Congressman Darren LaHood and Rodney Davis both point to trade and infrastructure as top federal issues impacting McLean County. The two Republicans were in Bloomington Tuesday at the McLean County Chamber of Commerce State of Congress event.
Davis says he thinks the U.S.-Mexico Trade Agreement, or USMCA, would have overwhelming bipartisan support. But he says it's in the hands of Speaker Nancy Pelosi to bring it to the U.S. House floor.
This is a good deal that I think could open the floodgates for some bilateral trade agreements with countries like China, with countries like Japan, South Korea, the UK, EU. I mean, these are opportunities for us to grow our markets, not just for our agricultural products, but for our manufacturers.
Davis says the U.S. has 500,000 open manufacturing jobs.
If you want to see a recession, don't pass the USMCA. Stop our ability to negotiate agreements with other countries, and then you'll see the economy go in the tank.
Davis says over 40% of U.S. products made in Illinois go to Canada or Mexico. And he says without passing the USMCA, there's no hope for a trade deal with China.
If we can't pass a deal like that in the House of Representatives, do the Chinese officials really believe that we're going to pass a bilateral Chinese-American agreement? Come on. There's no incentive for them.
Davis shares McLean County with Congressman Darren LaHood, who also believes passing the USMCA should be a top priority when session resumes next month. And with President Trump talking about a possible withdrawal from NAFTA, LaHood says he's concerned the U.S. would be left with no trade agreement. However, both Republicans remain optimistic.
If we can get the USMCA passed in a bipartisan way, I think that will be a good precursor to doing an infrastructure bill.
LaHood sits on the Ways and Means Committee, which is currently reviewing a bill to raise the federal gas tax 5 cents per year over the next 5 years to fund infrastructure. But LaHood says that alone wouldn't be enough. With popularity of electric vehicles on the rise, he says the gas tax will have increasingly little impact.
I hope with Rivian we keep going in that direction a lot more with our trucks and SUVs, but that's the direction we're going. So how do we capture those resources?
LaHood's Republican colleague has an idea. Rodney Davis says there needs to be a change to the Federal Highway Trust Fund. As of now, Davis says electric vehicles put nothing into the fund. As for the specifics on how to fill that fund, Davis wasn't specific. But the two Republicans agree infrastructure is vital to McLean County. One area the lawmakers are not keen on is the recent statewide increase to the minimum wage. LaHood says he worries the $15 minimum wage will hit rural communities in his district hard.
I was a bit frustrated having a district like I do, and I think Rodney feels the same way, that the state raised it to what they did without putting exemptions in for smaller communities.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker talked about adding those exemptions, but they did not make it into the law. Rodney Davis agrees smaller communities should have had a choice, but he adds universities and colleges to that list. Davis says Illinois State University approached him when the minimum wage increase was brought up on the federal level. He says the university was concerned about increasing the federal minimum wage during the state budget impasse. Both Davis and LaHood voted against the federal minimum wage bill. The congressman also opposed legalizing recreational marijuana. Illinois passed recreational cannabis earlier this year. LaHood says Washington isn't ready to pass that joint.
Does that create some legal dilemmas? Of course it does. As you see more states across the country that do what Illinois did. And if I was in the legislature, I wouldn't have supported it.
LaHood says at the end of the day, it's all within each state's rights. But his district neighbor Davis says he wouldn't have supported legalization either. Davis says his primary concerns now are about the effects on law enforcement and crime rates. He says he fears most for businesses that are forced to operate on cash only until a law is passed allowing cannabis sale companies to use federal banks.
Now I have to make sure that I pass federal legislation or co-sponsor and hope to pass federal legislation that would allow now legitimately operated companies in Illinois to use our financial institutions to be able to bank the money that they make by operating their business.
Davis says he's hopeful that measure would see bipartisan support in Washington and that he could get it passed before the Illinois law goes into effect on January 1st. Session picks up again next month. I'm Mary Cullen.
You're listening to 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We think of hospitals as places one goes to receive medical treatment. As Tim Shelley reports, though, OSF Healthcare is exploring ways to prevent people from ending up there in the first place.
Keeping people healthy depends on a lot more than just what services a hospital can offer. That's how Dr. Sarah Stewart de Ramirez sees it. And as OSF Innovation's Vice President and Chief Medical Officer for Clinical Innovation, it's her job.
We find that it's important in terms of thinking about the introduction of new tools, technologies, and innovations that we bear in mind that we, inside of the four walls of our hospital, do not determine the predominant amount of health outcomes that our patients are experiencing.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention estimates less than half a person's overall health is determined by formalized medical care. The factors making up most health issues are called social determinants of health. They include food insecurity, housing quality, mental health resources, health literacy, and access to transportation. Rural and low-income communities with less access to care also have more of these social challenges to health. 2 years ago, Ramirez and her team spearheaded the start of the Complex Solutions Innovation Team in Peoria, Monmouth, and Pontiac. The group tackles some of these day-to-day struggles to try to improve long-term health. Joe Garrison is the Director of Ambulatory Care for OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. OSF took an interest in food access issues in Peoria as grocery stores continue to close, particularly in the city's south side. Garrison says about 11% of Illinoisans are considered food insecure. In the 61605 zip code that covers the south side, it was more than 15%.
We exceeded the Illinois rate, and so we really thought, wow, we've got to put our heads together and we can do better than that.
OSF Healthcare formed a community garden committee with the city of Peoria, Peoria Park District, University of Illinois Extension, the Catholic Diocese of Peoria, and other organizations. OSF bought 2.1 acres of vacant lots from the city to start community gardens and hired a gardening coordinator. The focus, though, isn't just about boosting access to fresh foods and vegetables, but tackling the other social determinants of health and well-being. This includes cooking classes, workout routines, and enjoying the therapeutic calming benefits of gardening.
We're really looking at the whole behavior modification and behavior change to really hopefully enhance their knowledge and how that can impact their overall health.
Dave Ramirez says in rural communities like Pontiac and Monmouth, solutions are different for the challenges posed by social determinants of health. Smaller towns also have smaller networks of social service providers. She says people and healthcare providers need more screening for social health factors and a readily accessible network of data and analytics in order to better deploy solutions going forward. I'm Tim Shelley.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. GLT's digital content director Ryan Denham has been away this week, and not away, actually. Ryan has been subbing as a host on the 21st show you hear on 89.1 and WGLT.org. He joins us for a brief moment from that other university down I-74. Brian, how's the gig been going for you?
It has been a lot of fun. The crew here at WLL, which is the NPR station in Champaign-Urbana, is a lot of fun to work with. It's a very different vibe from the WGLT newsroom, so I am learning a ton. And we've got a couple more shows. We've got another one coming up on Thursday this week.
And what's up on that show?
Well, we're going to have a conversation about active shooter drills in schools. So if you think of your kid, being in a grade school, junior high, or high school or something, and these sort of emergency exercises that you go through, like a tornado drill or something like that, but it's for an active shooter. And when you do those, it comes with a lot of sort of really interesting trauma, too. I mean, you're putting someone through what is a very traumatic experience to prepare them for a really traumatic experience. So how does that work?
That's GLT's Ryan Denham. Hurry back, Ryan. And it's about what you'll hear tomorrow on the 21st show. Josh Ritter is known worldwide as a talented songwriter. Matter of fact, Paste magazine named him one of the 100 greatest living songwriters in 2006. Ahead of his show at the Castle Theater in Bloomington on Friday night, though, Ritter tells WGLT's John Norton that he altered his normal approach to writing and recording for the album that became Fever Breaks.
First, Ritter hired Americana star Jason Isbell to produce the new album and used Isbell's backing band, the 400 Unit, as his studio band. This is On the Water from Fever Breaks, a relationship song that would have sounded right at home on his 2013 album, Beast in Its Tracks.
I'm in love with you, honey, you got nothing to fear. You're standing over there and I'm standing right here.
But on Fever Breaks, Ritter also veers into political and social issues. Content, he says, he approaches gingerly.
It's a double-edged sword as an artistic sort of thing. You know, there are things about the song that if you are referencing things in a very specific way, become dated super fast and lose some of their power. There's also the fact that, like, I find that a lot of times if it's not done really well, I think that, like, political songwriting becomes kind of an exercise in education, which is not something that I want to do. I don't know anything more than anybody else. What I think a good protest song does is it frames moral arguments but doesn't answer them, allows them to be answered by the intelligence of the person listening to the song.
I saw my brother in a stranger's face. I saw my sister in a smile. My mother's laughter in a far-off place. My father's footsteps in each mile.
But Ritter said he couldn't shake the news he was reading and seeing. He said those events taking shape in his mind actually began forming a couple albums prior, and by the time he was writing for this album, a rising tide of dread and unease had come over him.
It took a while for those things to coalesce and for me to realize that trying to be a writer now and look inward would be for me a mistake of real proportions, you know? Like, the world is right now in turmoil, and to write about it only requires that you look up and look around. And it's my way of feeling like I can contribute to, like, a conversation and do what I can. And then, like, and there are other ways, and I get so frustrated with my inaction. But this is one way that I feel like I can help.
I saw the children in the holding pen. I saw the families ripped apart. And though I try, I cannot begin to know what I did inside their heart. There was a time when we held them close and weren't so cruel, low and mean. And we did good unto the least of those. Or was it all some kind of dream?
That line, "and we did good unto the least of those," to me that has a biblical reference to it. Does it have some kind of spirituality or religion behind it?
what you were writing in that line?
Well, you know, I think there are some major, major distractions in our social commentary about things right now. And two of the big ones are that things are political or things are religious, and that those are bedrocks upon which we base our realities. I have to think, and I really believe, that when we do good toward the people, we are not laying that decision to do good at the feet of God or of country or of political affiliation. What we are doing, kind works to other humans and kind works to those around us. The basis of our actions in our lives, we can trace them to whether we are doing good works for other people, and that has nothing to do with religion or party affiliation. It has to do whether we respect the humanity in everybody else.
I saw my country in the hungry eyes of a million refugees.
And so I'm using biblical language in there. If it's a way of like asking the question of somebody who is religious, to the least of these you do unto me, you know, that's a question that if you do espouse a strong Christian faith, that's a question you have to answer for right now.
For it seems that these are darker days than any others that we've seen. Oh, how we wish that we weren't wide awake and this was all some kind of dream.
So I want to move on to another song from the album. It's called The Torch Committee. Josh, it's really difficult for me not to think of Charlottesville when I see the title of this song, you know, the torch reference. What I take away from it is that it's sort of a commentary on how we follow orders, like sheep. You know, we don't question things. We just, maybe how you were saying earlier, we follow our religion, we follow our party, and we don't think for ourselves, maybe.
I found that I did have this feeling. And Charlottesville gave me a thing to focus on, and it was the pitiful image of people walking through the streets with torches. And like the idea that like you give the rabble a torch and give them something to be angry at, and they're going to be able to protect themselves from all the things that are truly wrong. And the torch became a thing that if you have a committee, if you have a way to like give and take away rights, it's a really terrifying combination.
Good evening, may we say again how pleased we are that you've come in. The day was long, your bed was soft, still there's some names we're crossing off. Says here by your file, you have been so loyal, brave and true. We need not fret, you need not fear, and so we come to why you're here.
The Torch Committee ended up being a song about how people can get lost in bureaucracy so quickly and become numbers and become forms. And that's one of the ways that people all over are being just dehumanized and desensitized to each other. And it's done with bureaucracy, and it's done with just something cold.
Wait, suppose that we untie your hands to sign upon this line to pledge that you have always been a patriot and citizen. Please ignore the legalese. Lawyers, am I right? Now see why we're so happy that you came. Appendix 3, a list of names.
The Torch Committee is the name of the song from Josh Ritter's brand new album. It's called Fever Breaks. This is WGLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Do you feel these times require artists to speak on these issues?
No, I don't. I don't think so, because I think that art, for it to be important and useful, has to follow whatever the preoccupations of the artist are. Every voice is important. Every person's experience during this time is important. But one of the things I do really believe, art made in this time will have a touch of this time in it. You know, if people have like very specific stories that need to be shared, it's such an important time to do that. And, you know, in this very same way that me writing songs about the things that I'm seeing, I'm tremendously lucky that I have that, you know, platform to do that. You know, I take it seriously and I try and do the right thing. But sometimes that means that, like, you know, I got to wake up in the morning and write a cowboy song, you know?
Yeah.
in this situation, there are moments where I just felt such fury and I turned to the one thing that I really know how to do.
There's mama standing with the knife still in her chest. As per her last instructions at her death. Said you'll never get to heaven, son, so go to hell real slow. Now the ground don't want me, mama. The ground don't want me, no, no, no.
us a lead track to our guest's new album, Josh Ritter, Fever Breaks, the album that's Ground Don't Want Me. I want to go to Twitter, social media. You are very active on Twitter, and you are also not afraid to tackle social issues on Twitter, but you're also not afraid to be kind, which is, you know, something that you're not supposed to do on Twitter. So the question is, what gives?
It's, you know, from when I began, like when I was first playing open mics and selling my record off the stage or whatever, I was amazed that they would buy a record, you know? And I never thought after that that they would actually take it home and listen to it. But as time goes by, you get less and less of a chance to necessarily always like hang out and meet people and share ideas and share like just normal like kindnesses and like courtesies towards each other. You would rather do it in person, but sometimes this is a good way to do it.
Well, Josh Ritter, it's great to talk with you. Thank you so much for giving us time to hear a little bit of your thoughts behind the album and what's going on in your life. I appreciate your time.
I really appreciate the talk, and thank you so much. What is the body when the soul is gone? Has it only been forgotten?
I want to lay down in a field of bone. WGLT's John Norton speaking with singer-songwriter Josh Ritter, who appears at the Castle Theater Friday night. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas, interviews, and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Ryan Denham, Tim Shelley, and Colleen Reynolds. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.